This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from the rural village of Pall Mall, Tennessee. Come along and join me for a visit with World War I U.S. Army hero, Sergeant Alvin York's daughter, 85-year-old Betsy Ross York Lowry, and great-granddaughter, Deborah York, at the family's farmhouse. A pacifist, York reluctantly went to war and wound up one of America's most highly decorated heroes. He was a recipient of the Medal of Honor for leading an attack on a German machine gun nest. York killed 25 and single-handedly captured 130 German soldiers during the final offensive of World War I in the Meuse-Argonne forest of France, just weeks before the signing of the armistice on November 11, 1918. Equal to his heroism on the battlefield was his life as an advocate for education following the war. York returned to his rural hometown and commenced a lifelong quest to build schools and provide opportunities for the disenfranchised rural children throughout the Cumberland Gap region of Tennessee. In addition to telling fascinating stories about her great-grandfather's heroic modesty on and off the battlefield, Deborah York, who's executive director of the Sergeant York Patriotic Foundation, offers insights about the nonprofit's mission to continue Sergeant York's lifelong passion for education and honoring U.S. military veterans.
My name is Betsy Ross York Lowry.
Betsy Ross was no accident, was it?
No, my dad named me that.
So all your brothers and sisters, they had very patriotic.
They have patriotic, yes. Yeah. He was very patriotic.
Mm-hmm. You're Deborah York?
Yes, Deborah York. I'm the executive director of the Sergeant York Patriotic Foundation and also great-granddaughter of Sergeant York.
And so you're a daughter?
I'm the daughter,
What are your memories of your dad?
Just he was dad. I don't have any.
Took him for granted.
He was just our dad, you know. He was just happy-go-lucky and just a good guy. Just good dad, good Christian guy. Very patriotic.
Brief background about your great-grandfather.
Brief background. It's tough to be brief. He lived such a rich life. Sergeant York was born and raised in Pall Mall, Tennessee. He was a hellion. His father actually was killed by a mule kick. He was a blacksmith. And so Sergeant York was actually the oldest living child in the home at the time. So he became kind of the breadwinner. He often said the pressures of that led him to drink and become kind of a hellion. Then he became a Christian in 1915. And turned his life around for God and for the love of a lady named Miss Gracie. It's a beautiful love story. So he was living a life of peace and love when the war found him.
So he was a pacifist.
He was. He was a conscientious objector, and he often said that how did this war find him from across the pond when he had just found peace and love and calm here at home? So he was a conscientious objector. He said he didn't want to go and fight, but his church that he belonged to was too small of a sect to be recognized by the government, so they denied his conscientious objector status. He then went on to basic training and became one of the sharpshooters within his group and one of the best soldiers that they had within training, because for him, shooting was survival. You didn't eat if you didn't kill game and put food on the table. So for him, getting meals given to him every day, three hot meals every day, a uniform with nice boots and a nice gun, he excelled as a soldier. So he caught the eye of his superiors, and they actually wanted him to start training the other troops of how to shoot. Sergeant York often said that he served with a lot of really good guys from all over the country, but they didn't just miss the target, they missed the hill that the target was sitting on. because a lot of the city kids had never fired a whip. So Sergeant York excelled, but they understood he was a conscientious objector. So he actually had some spiritual debates and discussions with his superiors, and they actually awarded him a furlough. They let him come home to pray about going to war, and there's an outcropping of a hillside. It's called the Yellow Doors. It's cliffs that are up on the mountainside where he would often go when he needed some peace and quiet. So he actually came home and spent a few days up there with his Bible and his dog and prayed about whether he would go to war or not. And he often said it wasn't that he was afraid to die for his country. He didn't want to kill for his country. That was what he was grappling with. But then he came to peace with it, and he ended up shipping out with his unit. It was the 82nd All-American Division, which is now the 82nd Airborne Division. Oh, wow. Out of Fort Bragg is where it is now. But he was in Georgia for his basic training. So he shipped out, and his life changed forever on October 8th, 1918.
So once he was there, some phenomenal things happened to him. What are the odds?
Exactly. And like Josh said earlier, it was kind of the perfect storm in Sergeant York's world, to where, because he was raised so poor and they would recycle the bullets, they would actually dig them out of the trees and remelt them when he was a kid and growing up in Pall Mall, he actually picked up the bullets that soldiers were discarding because they were in the muck and the mire of the war, and the guys that were coming out from the front lines were just dropping their belts because of the weight of it, and they were just exhausted. So he actually picked up a lot more ammunition than what he was issued. A lot of people don't realize his story was tied to the Lost Battalion. They weren't actually lost. They had actually become separated from the American Army and were secluded and were getting killed at a phenomenal rate. So his unit was sent to silence the German machine guns and to help rescue the Lost Battalion, and then also to cut off the supply line. The Dockerville Railroad ran right through there, which was the main supply line to the German forces. So his unit was sent, and they were gunned down by the machine guns, and Sergeant York went into hunting mode. He was angry at the death and destruction that he saw around him, and he decided he had to stop the killing. And so he actually kept hollering, "Please surrender, please surrender." And the Germans' account, they thought they were surrounded by more soldiers than what they actually were, because he was such a good shot. So they really thought there were more people out shooting, except it was Sergeant York.
One guy.
Exactly. But he was able to maneuver through the woods very quietly, meticulously, and he called it tetched them off. He would call to the Germans, and they would raise their heads up to get the machine guns firing over the mound to get to the soldiers, and he would tetch them off one by one. So he ended up capturing 132 soldiers.
One guy.
One guy. There were seven left in his battalion that, as he would capture the soldiers, he would give the troops, his own troops, command over, you know, make sure to keep these guys in line and make sure they don't do anything. And then he would go out and try to silence more machine guns up on the hillside.
One guy.
Mm-hmm.
And a pacifist.
A pacifist to boot. And there were accounts after the war where they actually, the commanders didn't believe them. And they said, "Sergeant York, you're going to have to take us and show us, Alvin, what you actually did in the war." And he said it was not manpower. It was a higher power that allowed this to happen, because he did not have a hair on his head that was disturbed. And if you looked at the terrain then, everything was just chopped down from the machine gun fire. And so one of the generals actually asked him, he said, "Alvin, I heard you captured the whole damn German army." And he said, "No, sir, just 132. But it was one of those battles that was instrumental in bringing an end to the war, because they were able to not only boost morale, but they were able to cut off that supply line to the Germans. So this happened October 8th, and the war came to an end November the 11th.
It's incredible, because the U.S. participation in World War I was not that long a time.
Exactly.
Basically a year.
Yes, exactly. But we had a profound impact because the other troops had been there so long and were just becoming decimated. Largest mobilization of American troops at that time, absolutely.
When did your father come home?
When did he come home?
Yeah.
I wasn't born when he came home.
I know. May of 1919.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's actually the interesting part about his story that a lot of people don't know, is they just assume it's like today where they come back on airplanes. Well, they had just mobilized the largest American force. They didn't know how to get him home. So he was actually in France from the end of the war in November through May when they were able to get a ship to bring him home. So that's when he really got the experience of going out and realizing how big the world was. He saw electricity. He saw indoor plumbing. He went to all of the major attractions in Paris, the Arc. He went to the museums, the cathedrals, and universities. He just walked around and tried to assimilate and process what he had been through, but also to realize how he wanted life to be different when he came home. And he actually was at the very first meeting of the American Legion that was held in Paris, France. And I loved his quote. He wrote in his journal, he said, "I think it's right smart that we have an organization that keeps these boys in contact with each other, because we left America as strangers, but we're going home as brothers who love one another."
Betsy, did he ever talk about after the war when he was still in Europe and, like she said, going to France?
He never did tell us about anything much that happened. If someone came in to talk with him and ask him questions, he would give an answer or something like that. You might hear a little bit. But he never did talk to us about the war, what he went through or anything.
I think one of the most phenomenal untold stories of Sergeant York outside of here locally is post-World War I, what he did. That's an incredible story.
It was phenomenal that if you think about a guy who barely had a third grade education, who got plucked out of the mountains of Tennessee, basically illiterate, but very street smart, very, very savvy and street smart, had a lot of survival skills, very intellectual, but no book learning, that he was able to assimilate and incorporate what he experienced and bring it back, and he wanted to give back. He wanted the next generation to have things that his generation didn't have. I mean, he was so non-judgmental, but he was very compassionate and very much wanting to use that negative experience and turn it into a positive for future generations.
It really specifically targeted things that he did.
Yes.
It wasn't just this big dreams.
Yes.
It was, let's build a school.
Yes. Let's build roads. Let's build bridges. Let's build schools. He went around raising money, giving speeches to say, look, these mountain children deserve a chance, and they are economically disadvantaged, geographically isolated. We've got to get some roads, some bridges, some schools so that they can be part of America like they need to be, and they need opportunities like all Americans have. And so he actually built three schools, the largest of which was York Institute.
That was public school, right?
It was a public school. He ran it for several years, and then he ended up giving 400 acres and the school to the state of Tennessee. It was the largest high school campus in the state of Tennessee, and it was actually a full-time school before education was mandatory in the state. So he gave 400 acres, and then he gave it to the state with a handshake and a promise that they would always run it as a free school for all children, and it's still run to this day.
In the building, the old school building that's closed right now, you guys are in the middle of rebirthing that. Tell us about its next incarnation.
Absolutely. It was built in 1927, and it was operated until 1979 when the state moved next door to a newer building. It is on the National Historic Registry, and it's a building of national significance. Unfortunately, it was in such disrepair that the state had it slated for demolition, and the Sergeant York Patriotic Foundation, the family, and some concerned citizens rallied and fought to save it from demolition, and it is now becoming the Sergeant York Center for Peace and Valor. We've just launched our campaign to raise the funds. We want it to be a free place to serve the country, just like Sergeant York wanted to serve the country back in the 20s. We want it to be a space that gives back and serves the country based on the principles of the Medal of Honor.
Give us some specific tangibles, like some of the rooms we went through. What will be in there? What will people see and experience?
We want it to be a tribute to all veterans. We want it to be a space where veterans can come and actually experience some healing to give back to the youth. We want to incorporate the Medal of Honor character development curriculum, as well as a retreat site. So we want it to be a youth leadership site to where kids from all over the country can come here and experience the healing power of the ruralness of East Tennessee, as well as this building that's such an iconic building built by such an iconic historical figure, and get in touch with our heroes, our history and our heroes. But we want it to be a youth leadership training site, a site for veterans, have some museum exhibits in there.
Will you have veterans that will be on staff that will be teaching the kids? Will you have retreats where they can overnight and
yes,
get a really immersive experience?
Yes, we've actually talked to several groups, and we want it to be advantageous and a healing space and a giving back space for the entire country, specific to veterans, connecting with our youth. Our veterans have such wonderful experience and training and wisdom to impart to the youth, to make that connection between the veterans and our youth through using the Medal of Honor character development and then expanding upon that to actually host retreats. We're working in conjunction with Pickett State Park that has a wonderful camp where we can house the participants, whether they're children, whether they're veterans, whether they're families of veterans, that they can come and use this space as a conduit and have it be a cathartic experience to where they're connecting with one another, people that understand what it's like to serve, and then imparting that wisdom onto the youth. So through programming, through exhibits, we also want to have the cultural aspect, because so much healing happens through cultural events, whether it's music, whether it's plays.
This is a 20,000 square foot space.
23,000 square feet, and it was built in the 20s, and it our foundation has invested just over $2.6 million to get it to the place where it's ready for restoration. Mm-hmm. So we're actually taking it upon ourselves to raise the money and to build this so it can always stand and always give back. Whether it's art classes, college classes, whether it's retreats, it is for the youth and it is for our veterans. Those are the two groups of people that Sergeant York lived and worked his entire life to serve, and we feel like carrying forward with that mission, as long as it sticks with the principles of the Medal of Honor, then it's going to work perfectly.
Okay, but these dreams to come to become reality, it takes a capital campaign.
Yes.
Yeah, it
yes.
takes some investiture of people that believe in that.
Yes.
So you're just now starting a capital campaign, correct?
We are, and so we need help.
So how do people help?
We need all the help we can get. I'm hoping we got a touch of Sergeant York's stubbornness to see this through.
Tenacity, anyway.
Tenacity, exactly. But we want it to stand for courage, commitment, sacrifice, patriotism, integrity, and citizenship. Mm-hmm. And so in today's world, I just can't think of a better place, a better topic, and a better space than peace and the courage to stand for peace. So yes, we need all the help we can get. We are actually going to have a hall of honor to where we want to honor veterans with putting their names and their ranks and their years of service in a hallway that will always stand in Sergeant York's building. We also want to have bricks out front to build a little veterans park out front. So there's ways where people can actually leave their part of their legacy in the building itself for future generations to always see.
And make a contribution at the same time.
And make a contribution at the same time. I see it as kind of our time to carry this torch forward to the next generation, but it's our opportunity to leave our legacy in that building and leave a legacy for future generations about what America really is and what America can be.
How does somebody find out more?
SGTYORK.org. So it's SergeantYork.org. That's our website for our foundation. We're a small nonprofit, mm-hmm. so we do need all the help we can get, and we would love to have contributions. We would love to have people come and visit, but SergeantYork.org, and there's a donate button on the website, and our mailing address is Sergeant York, P.O. Box 100, Pall Mall, Tennessee, 38577. So you can go on the website or you can mail donations to those two locations.
So, Betsy, as you pointed out, you weren't born yet when your father was in World War I, but you grew up here.
And I did.
And we're sitting in your living room
exactly.
of your family farm.
Exactly.
And all the furniture, the seats we're sitting in.
This was in the hallway.
Okay.
This was a couch and whatever. Yeah. So it's been arranged since they've taken it.
Right, you know. It's moved position, but you yeah. grew up with these.
I grew up in this house, mm-hmm. ate at that table, played the piano, me and my brother, and we'd sing and just have a good time together.
Do you ever feel your father's spirit?
Well, it's a lot of memories in this house, mm-hmm. a lot of memories.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Okay, so growing up, your dad was back to being a civilian, and he was a farmer here, right?
Right.
And had a grist mill. But also, as you pointed out earlier, God was central to what drove his life.
Right. We always went to church. We always had prayer at nighttime. Somebody would read the Bible and pray before we went to bedtime. Yeah. We'd all get around. Yeah. He says time for prayer or whatever, and we just come in the living room.
And then he started a Bible, like a school. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, it's up on the hill, but it's not open right now. But what's it going to do? You tell them they're going to do something with it, Debbie.
It's actually part of the state park that Miss Gracie sold to the state before she passed. And she wanted it to always be open. We're working with the state park system to refurbish that. It's also a building that's been vacated since the 50s. That was one of the two reasons that Sergeant York was finally convinced to make the movie in the 40s with Gary Cooper playing his role. One was the buildup to World War II, the atrocities that were happening in Europe. He felt led to intervene again. And then the number two reason was he wanted to use the money from the movie to build a Bible school.
But I think that's an interesting point. Your dad came back the biggest hero of World War I in America in many respects, and yet didn't want the spotlight, didn't want the limelight.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I know everybody loves my dad, and so did we, and he was a good guy. He was a wonderful father. Mm-hmm. And all, and I know people think a lot of him and speak highly of him, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, but he just wanted to be a regular guy, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Just a regular guy, regular farmer.
And he turned down a lot of opportunities.
I love the story of Sergeant York when he came back on the ship, that there were crowds in New York. He didn't realize that there was a reporter that had been embedded with his group that actually had run an article that had already run his story in America. So there were thousands of people that came to greet his ship. And I love the story that he told, that he said he actually wanted to stay on the ship until the crowd dissipated. They said, Alvin, come on, we got to go. And he said, I'm just going to wait till the crowd goes away. It's all right, too many people there for me. And they looked at him and they said, well, Alvin, they're here for you. And they actually had a ticker tape parade and took him down the streets of New York City with a ticker tape parade. And he leaned over and he goes, well, isn't this nice? They do this for all the soldiers returning. He had no concept that he had become so famous here in America because the article preceded his return home.
That's incredible, isn't it?
That's true, yeah. He gave out, when at York Institute, he gave out diplomas until he had his stroke, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was the last one class that graduated he gave out or not. That was in 51, so he may have done 52 before he had his stroke, and he may have been 54.
Until then, he was at school whenever he could be, right?
Yeah, it was a school, yeah.
But right. He was there. He was the head of it.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing, he basically, like you said, he was illiterate.
Basically illiterate, but he was very intelligent with life skills. And so he turned that tenacity and those survival skills into a passion for learning. So he came back and actually stocked a room in his house with books.
And they're still right there behind us.
They are. He had an avid library. He hired a tutor from New York City to move down to help tutor him. And it's fascinating to see the evolution of his speeches. At first, the tutor and his confidant was writing a lot of his speeches, and he would just mark out a few words to make it more realistic to country speak. But then as it evolved, he actually started writing his own speeches and became an avid reader and a really articulate speaker. He was a very big man, a very booming voice, and he had such a presence. And he had a heart for the people. It was never about fame. It was never about acquiring wealth. It was always about serving God and country and family and making the world a better place just by being here. And he really lived those principles his entire life. And I think that's why his story touches so many people. And it's humbling as a family member to meet the visitors from all over the world here that come to little old Pall Mall, Tennessee to actually walk the ground that Sergeant York walked. And so many people come here with tears in their eyes, and they say that they're here because they either became a Christian or they actually went into the military because of Sergeant York's story. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that he wasn't a perfect person. He led a rough, rough life. In fact, my grandpa was a preacher, and Sergeant York and he were having a discussion about the movie after the movie came out. And my grandpa said, he said, Dad, he said, were you really as bad as what that movie made you out to be? And his dad looked at him and said, Son, I got to tell you, I was much worse. He said, it was only by the saving grace of God that I was able to do what I did and actually turn my life around. And so he stayed grounded in those principles. It's not to say he didn't struggle with what he went through with the war, because you never go to war and come back the same person. You never serve this country and you're never the same again. But it's not to say that you can't turn that turmoil and that grief and that destruction into something positive. And that's what he did the rest of his life, which I think is the phenomenal legend and legacy that he has left for all of us.
And the other thing we didn't touch on enough is when he came back, as you point out, he was literally offered the equivalent of millions of dollars.
Yeah. Millions of dollars. With contracts, with endorsements, they wanted him to come to be in plays, and he very much shied away from it. He kept saying, this uniform ain't for sale, and what we did over there wasn't for fame or wasn't for glory. It was for America, and it was for freedom, and it was for the people that were being taken advantage of because of the situations that were happening in war. And he said, you know, there's a lot of soldiers that aren't coming back. There's a lot of soldiers that we served with that are staying over there in graves, and this soldier is not for sale.
When I graduated, this was a class ring they gave us. It's got Dad's picture on one side and the school interest on the other side. And then it says, that was the York Agricultural Institute. Now, when other people graduated, theirs wasn't quite as big like this. There was a smaller ring. I don't know if they had the picture on it or not. I don't remember. But anyway, I graduated in 51.
After you graduated, yeah.
I went to Tevecca Nazarene College for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And then I got married in 52. And then we lived here from 52 to 57. With my mom and dad, and then we moved to Bowling Green, and my husband went to Western Kentucky University, and so we retired.
So you lived in Kentucky most of your adult life?
Yeah, except for 1 year, we went to Nashville, and we moved back to Bowling Green.
All right, Betsy Ross, I love it.
My name was Betsy Ross.
Tell them some of the other patriotic names in your family.
The first one was named after Dad. Was Evans C. York Jr. George Edward Buxton was her dad. Buxton was one of Dad's majors that he wanted one of his sons to be named after. Then I had Woodrow Wilson, Sam Houston, Andrew Jackson, Betsy Ross, Mary Alice, which was after both grandmothers, and then Thomas Jefferson was a baby.
So you had half of American history in your own family.
Yes,
he was very patriotic.
Very patriotic. In fact, Sergeant York tried to enlist in World War II.
Oh,
and
wow.
He was told that he was too fat and too old, too out of shape. But they made him an honorary colonel and let him go across the country selling war bonds and actually giving speeches to increase morale for the troops going back across.
Well, Deborah York and Betsy Ross York, what an honor and a pleasure and a special day.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
It's nice meeting you. Hope you enjoyed your visit.
I still am.
Okay.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.